Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, January 30th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. As always, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and the only way that I can afford to continue to do this show with no help is through support from my listeners. You guys are amazing. And this week, those of you who went to www.patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged your support are Mark Hepburn, Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Christian Jeffrey, David Lacer, Jeffrey Perez, Stuart Ogg, the Honorable Husband, Charles Payette, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Of course, there are many, many, many more that I can't even name. Those are our top supporters. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. You remember you can also visit the PayPal portal by going to carasantamaria.com. And this week I want to thank Diane Adams for your generous support. You can also support the show in other ways. You can visit the Talk Nerdy store and pick up some super cool gear, or just rate on iTunes, share it with your friends, reach out on social media and say hi. Tell me what you want to hear about. All of that stuff is super helpful. And I love communicating with you guys. Okay, that's enough business. I want to start the show, and I'm really excited because I finally have another person live in studio with me, which I haven't had in a while. I've been doing a lot of remotes, and she is, let me see if I can think of the best way to, I'm talking about her in third person, and she's looking right at me, which is weirding her out. She is a celebrity makeup artist, right? And kind
I'll
of,
take it.
Yeah, celebrity makeup artist who is venturing in some really cool new things that maybe we'll get to talk about. And she's also a very good friend of mine. We met when we worked on a show together, so I spent at least like 2 hours a day in the makeup chair with you daily for like a year.
Yeah.
And we got to be super, super good friends. She also, interestingly, which is why I'm super excited to have her on the show, was raised as a Jehovah's Witness. So we're going to talk about that a lot. But here she is, Val Harvey. I call you Val.
Yeah, call me Val.
Everyone calls you Val. Yeah. What's your real first name?
Valerie.
Oh, it's Valerie. Okay. Yeah. It's not like, Valencia or anything.
No,
weird.
It's not that glamorous. Valeria, if you want to like get really fancy with it.
Valeria.
That's like my that. Latina name.
I like so. That. Yeah, you are Latina, aren't
I
you?
I am. Yeah.
So
I am.
Ostensibly you are African American. You're Latina, African American.
I would say Afro-Caribbean.
Afro-Caribbean. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So where's your family originally from?
Originally from Panama.
Cool.
Yeah, but like we've got Caribbean roots going back to like the Virgin Islands, St. Croix, Jamaica.
Ooh, girl. Do you ever go back to those places?
Yeah. I've been to Jamaica a couple times. I go back to Panama. It's fantastic there. I love it. I love Central America. I think it's just one of the most amazing parts of the world. It's just all rainforest and, you know, like there's Bocas del Toro, which is my favorite island out there. It's an island off of Panama that's almost completely untouched, you know.
But is there a lot of people that live there?
It is. And what's great about Panama is that people speak English there because of the American occupation up until 2000. So you get the best of a, you know, like metropolis type city, and then you also get that beautiful like indigenous rainforest feel too. It's got both. You've got skyscrapers and then you've got rainforest.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love it there. It's cool.
Oh, that sounds great. And what percentage, I know like when I go to Puerto Rico, because I have Puerto Rican roots, right? And I always think of Puerto Rican.
I know. I like the way you rolled your R's earlier. She's on.
Yeah. And I always think of Puerto Rico as like very multicultural, which it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of us think of Puerto Ricans
as J-Lo.
Well, we think of like the Puerto Rican representatives that we see in TV and film. Uh-huh. And we think of maybe some of us who grew up in New York or spent time in New York. We think of a very specific kind of New Yorican vibe.
Yeah.
And I'm like super white. Like I look very white, but I'm like very Puerto Rican.
Right.
When I was reading about, because I was doing 23andMe and I was really interested to see what my genetic roots are, I was reading online something like 50% of Puerto Ricans are like light skin, like they're white.
Oh, really?
Because they're so Spanish.
Yeah. Nature, that makes a lot of sense.
But like I have cousins there that are so much darker than I am. What is it like when you're in Panama?
Panama's really interesting because of the canal. It just, I mean,
brought people together.
You know, melting pot of people that flooded through there and that were brought there to build the canal. You've got Asians, you've got Latins, you've got blacks, you've got whites. You really have everything there because, you know, like, I mean, John McCain's from, he was born in Panama.
Yeah, yeah, that's so funny.
You know, so yeah, like you really get a lot, you get a lot of military, you know. So it's interesting. It's an interesting culture. And my family has really deep roots there. My mother was born and raised there. My father was born and raised there. My father's parents, I believe, were born and raised in you know, Caribbean islands. Mm-hmm. And then they came to Panama, I imagine, for the canal.
Yeah.
But my grandmother on my mother's side was born and raised in Panama as well.
Oh, wow. So yeah,
and
there a while.
Yeah, so deep, deep roots. And my grandfather on my maternal grandfather was born in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just one of those things where we've been there a long, long time.
I love
time.
That. So living,
and I was born there too.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I was born there. I was 5 when I came to this country.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
So do you speak Spanish?
Girl, no.
Yeah. I'm
I wish.
So with you. I know.
I'm terrible.
I'm the same way. Well, you know, if your parents don't speak it around you and they don't raise you in it, like, it's
Well, it's
tough.
One of those things that where, I mean, we moved to this country in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
85, and that was when it wasn't cool to be foreign.
Yeah.
So my parents were like, nope, you're speaking English. That's that.
So and you plus, had it, but you lost it.
Oh, yeah. Like, Spanish is my first language. But they also kind of did this shady thing where they're like, well, then we can talk about the kids. We can have full-on conversations about them without them knowing what we're talking about.
I love that. That's
can
hilarious.
I swear or do I keep it loose?
Oh, no. Yeah, I fucking swear on the show. No, okay. Yeah, I have an explicit rating. We're all good, girl.
Oh, yeah. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Good. Whew, because that would stress me out I couldn't
really hard.
Swear.
It's really hard to do. I know. We had to. No, that's true. On the show that we worked on together, I think we were allowed to swear, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
We could say what we wanted, which was awesome. Yeah, helpful because I'm not good at self-censoring because it was live, which makes it so hard.
Right.
So, but here living in the States, right, you were an immigrant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
very interesting because I've always had citizenship because my father was a citizen. He was in the army.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he did to mm-hmm. be able to get citizenship. I didn't ever
so you
ask
didn't
questions.
Have to go through naturalization.
So I didn't have to go through naturalization. My mother did.
Yeah.
And then I have a sister who she's, well, all my sisters are halves, but one of my half sisters that grew up with me, she had to go through naturalization mm-hmm. and only was a resident and then moved to Australia. And now she's an Australian citizen.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
But yeah, I never really had to go through that process, but I am very seriously thinking about getting my Panamanian passport just in case.
Seriously. I mean, it's
not going to be bad to be a dual citizen right now.
You know, I mean, it brings up, we were just talking about this off air before we started. I've been struggling a little bit with Talk Nerdy, especially knowing, you know, what topics do we broach? What kind of episode do I want to bring to the listeners, right? Because
for
obviously
sure.
You turn on the news, and this is not just an American phenomenon. I have listeners from all over the world.
Uh-huh.
It's the same everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is talking about this, following what's going on with Trump, especially what's going on with Bannon, who seems to kind of be pulling the strings, and exactly what, especially this executive order, this quote-unquote Muslim ban, which really is what it is. I know has been bringing to the forefront,
mm-hmm.
and I'm of two minds about it. Like, part of me wants to just go deep into it and say, "Oh, I'll book a guest on that, you know, has expertise in this area, constitutional lawyer, and we'll talk specifically about this and really dedicate a whole hour." Because I find myself going on Twitter and going on the news and just falling into these rabbit holes. But then mm-hmm. I'm always mad at myself for doing it because I'm depressed.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So the other mind is, let's just talk about something totally different on the show and give people a respite.
There are other things happening in the world.
It's true.
I mean, I'm definitely trying to stay conscious, but it's always in my face. I don't need to look for it.
Yeah, it's everywhere. You know? I mean, and it's such a tough situation. I mean, I'm really proud and honored by the ACLU and by the hard work that they're doing. I was reading, as of today, I think they raised close to $20 million over the weekend, you know, because, I mean, people get it.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is a story that we need to continue to follow. And Maybe soon I will do an episode dedicated to these issues. I'm very vocal on social media, so obviously if you want to hear my my positions, you can find me there. But in the meantime, I thought it would be fun to switch gears and do a show where we focused a little bit on religion, because I feel like I haven't done that lately in the show. I've been doing a lot of science, which, you know, is my favorite, a lot of skepticism.
Yeah.
But one of the kind of tiers of talk nerdy that a lot of people have grown to love is kind of the atheism bent, right? I talk a lot about atheism.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm interested to know, you, I mean, you're an ex-Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
How do you identify now?
You know, that's very very interesting question. I guess I would call myself maybe agnostic, but I've kind of floated into that realm where I definitely have a consciousness and awareness of, you know, like something bigger than me. You know, I definitely feel that. I don't, and I feel like people should find God or source or, you know, whatever they're connected to, where they feel the most connected to it. And for some people, it's church. Some people can go and sit, you know, and listen to the preacher on a pulpit and really find that connection with God. For me, I love nature and I am very inspired and, just very thankful and grateful of, you know, my place in this world when I'm out in nature. So that's where I find source or God or whatever you want to call it, just some sort of like, you know, peaceful feeling. So that's where I search for it. And like, to each his own. So that's kind of where I'm at. I don't like, I can't, like, church is not going to be the place where I'm going to resonate with, you know, that higher being. So I just don't do it anymore.
Yeah. And if you even see it that way, you know, I obviously, because I not because I self-identify as an atheist, but I identify as an atheist because I don't believe in any sort of higher like being, like a physical being, you know, with a consciousness out
and
there.
And I totally get that.
Yeah. But I do definitely resonate with exactly what you're describing. I think a lot of scientists do this sense of being a part of something larger than themselves, a sense of noticing how incredibly small we really are and finding profundity and beauty
and
in
sense.
Nature. Yeah, that is, I think, a very kind of scientific view. And it doesn't require any sort of what we might call anything spiritual, maybe, spiritual or supernatural, I think is a better way to put it. It doesn't require that you actually have a belief beyond anything that is materialistic. It simply requires that you don't have a lot of hubris, that you don't think like man is the most powerful. I personally, you know, am not beholden to the laws of nature. Like, obviously I am. And obviously, the more that you understand about the vastness of the universe, the more you realize how small and insignificant and kind of temporal you really are. You know, this is just a blip in a long stream of time. And we need to figure out, I think, how to manage the decisions that we make today because they have a lasting effect on the future.
Yeah.
Like, the moment should be the moment. It shouldn't also control the future.
Oh, yeah. It's I don't need that butterfly effect. Like, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I've got a perfectly good uterus that I'm never going to let anybody put a baby in because
I am so with you.
I just don't like, I'm just like, we are fucking shit up.
It's true. And you know,
I just don't want any other dependents, you know, putting their carbon footprint on this world. I'm like, I feel like I'm doing, you know, enough on my own.
And it's hard not to, you know, because we've built up a culture that almost requires it. We were talking about this on Skeptics Guide, the other podcast I work on recently, and kind of saying the exact same thing, which is that we as kind of human beings just simply don't have a lot of foresight. Like, we make decisions for the present. We don't think about the future. And that's how we find ourselves in all these parallel messes. Obviously, climate change being a really, really big one, being kind of the most obvious.
No.
Yeah, right? The one that's so pressing. But on top of that, we're talking about stories about space junk, sending up satellites and not thinking about how to bring them down. We're talking about stories about plastic in the oceans, like the production of plastic, which is so important for industrialization and so necessary. But then how are we using it? Just single use, horrible plastics that we throw away that are polluting the oceans and just there's so many things that we do where it's like, oh, this is helpful right now. We just don't even think about tomorrow. And we've got to start changing that. And obviously, this new administration is just a slap in the face when it comes to that mentality.
Well, hopefully 4 years doesn't set us that far back.
Oh, my God. I'm hoping that we do something prior to that four-year mark.
I mean, I don't know, man. Pence is pretty fucking awful, too.
It's true. Pence is awful, but I feel like at least
he's not a complete madman.
Like. Yeah, at least he might play the game with some sort of kind of respect to the office.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But this, I think Pence would be a very conservative, very Republican, Democratic leader. I think that Donald Trump is day after day reinforcing that he is not a Republican, that he has, you know, fundamentally fascist ideals, and that he really is doing what he can to try to throw the balance of powers out of whack and to try to assume power beyond what the executive branch should, which is a very scary and dangerous precedent that
he's
setting.
Drunk with power.
Very drunk
with power. Is really what it boils down to. He's like, so like, I can do anything.
And it's
right
our
now.
Job in a functioning democracy to remind not just him, but the other branches of government, especially your representatives, you know, I'm always pushing, call your representatives.
Yeah.
It's our job to remind them that that is their role, is to provide checks and balances, and that you cannot govern by mandate and you cannot govern by executive order alone. It's just, it's a danger. It's what dictators do. It's a dangerous way to go about it. So enough of that, Shabir. Enough of that. I wanted to talk about religion. You know, I'm very kind of famously, I don't know, famously, but obviously is a better word for it, anti-religion. Mm-hmm. I'm not just an atheist, but I have a lot of problems with religion. I'm not anti- just like we were talking about, individual religion.
Yeah.
Like, you know, somebody's individual relationship with it. I'm kind of anti a lot of the negative consequences of organized religion.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one, I think, of the more interesting organized religions here in the United States that a lot of people maybe don't get enough conversation about is the Jehovah's Witness. I don't know much about it, you know.
Yeah.
I was raised Mormon. We hear a lot lately about Scientology.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of people put those three sort of, they're not the same at
box.
All, but they're sort of like the, ooh, those are like black box, like kooky, crazy religions.
Yeah. Well, I think that what happens with those three religions is that they fall into the cult category because of how brief their time here in the world has been. And when I exited being a Jehovah's Witness, and I mean, I definitely had my, you know, like, oh, they're fine. And, you know, I still was almost a little attached to it, but then, and they also, you know, as you know, when you're a Jehovah's Witness, they basically try to control all of the information. So they create their own literature. They have their own Bibles. They have like everything. You're discouraged to read something like even a glamour magazine because you could get these ideas and then that could lead you astray. And so
it is very similar to Scientology.
Oh,
in that
absolutely.
Way.
They control all the incoming information. They try to discourage you from doing any type of secular education, you know, or higher education whatsoever so that they can, you know, control the dialogue for you. And when they do that, you know, for me, like when I finally got the courage to leave, I was still like, oh, they're fine. And I still almost had, you know, it's hard to just be like, okay, I'm going to do whatever I want now. You still get that feeling and the guilt. And
absolutely.
It takes, because
it's so in you.
It is. It wrote a program in my brain for so long. It was 21 years.
Yeah, let me get the timeline. So were you born in it?
No, okay. I was, when we moved to the United States, I was about 5 years old. And that's when my mother, you know, she ran into them. And I believe, she's actually told me before that I think my grandparents were Jehovah's Witnesses.
Gotcha. So she already had like a kind of an understanding.
Exactly. And she was the type of person that was constantly searching for truth and needed that, you know, tie to, you know, somebody who was telling her what was right and wrong. And we got here, and I believe my aunts were already living in California, and a Jehovah's Witness had stopped by my aunt's house and started studying the Bible with her. And then she told them about my mom, and they visited my mom, and we were off to the races. Yeah. And interestingly enough, my aunt is not a Jehovah's Witness, and she was like, meh. And like, we stay Jehovah's Witnesses. But in retrospect, I do think that like at the time it was a good thing. It's taken a while for me to be like okay with it all, when we'll get there. But
yeah, no, it's true. When you first leave, like, there's obviously a lot of anger.
Yeah,
and
yeah. So
confusion.
I was 5. I left when I was 26.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and so now I'm
so 21 years. Wow.
Coming in fast on 37. So
I love that you're honest about your age.
I don't care.
I'm the same way.
Yeah,
I'm like, because I feel like until I really start, like until I start looking older than I am, as long as I look younger than my age, I like the feeling of telling somebody how old I am and they're like, "You're what?"
Yeah, yeah.
No. And
yeah.
I'm like,
I say
you.
It as many times as I can.
I have friends who straight up lie about their age. They'll be like, "I'm 27," and
I
like,
lie about my age on Tinder. No.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But that is only because when you put down that you're a certain age, men, because of this fucking patriarchal, misogynistic rape culture that we live in, they cut it off at like 28, and then you don't get the prime pickings.
Yeah,
man.
Even 40, like 45-year-old men are like, "I'm not going to date."
Yeah, they like, they're like, "Oh, I'm stopping at 30," and I'm like, there's a whole crop of guys I'm not seeing.
Yet all the 20 some odd year old girls are like, "I don't want to date a 45-year-old
Yeah,
guy."
Exactly. And I'm like, hey, you get the best of both worlds. I don't act like a little girl, but I look young.
Yeah.
Don't you want a woman that looks like
and
a
you don't
young
want
girl?
Kids?
Yeah.
Which is very different than a lot of people.
Totally.
And I'm definitely in that category as well.
Right.
Definitely. But I've been off the market for a while. I'm boring.
Good for you.
I'm like a boring old lady. I love it. I love it. I can't remember the last time I shaved my legs.
Oh my God.
It's the best. No, actually, I'm going in for laser hair removal next week.
I love it. Are you getting the Punaner done?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure if I need to. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's almost like dating you, because like I went for laser, and it was specifically like to get my cha-cha done.
Yeah, a lot of people like to do it for their bikini line.
Yeah, you know, I get the bumps. So,
yeah. Which is fair. I want to do. Sorry, this has gone very girly. I like something like 80% of my listeners are men, so that you're just getting an education right now. I want to do my underarms, and I definitely want to do the bottom half of my legs. Just anything where like it's a pain in the shower.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't mind. And it's because I have to shave my underarms every day, or at least I try to.
Yeah.
And then when I do take the time to shave my legs, it's like really time consuming.
Yeah.
I don't mind shaving my bikini line because it's quick, it's small. Or like my upper leg is really quick because it's like no woman is like really hairy, like above her knee, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But from the knee down, it's just so time consuming. And so it'd be so nice if I didn't have to. Because I know it never completely gets rid of it and you have to go back. It will, yeah, but you have to do a lot of sessions. And
well, you've got the perfect skin type for it, because it works really well with very light skin and very dark hair.
That's the best case scenario. I'm so Mediterranean.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
So,
what I look
girl,
like.
you'll be fine.
So, is it harder? It's harder when you have darker skin.
Oh yeah, like I had to go for a specific laser.
Gotcha. Because otherwise, I can't find the follicle.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, you can't do it over tattoos.
Yeah, which I'm not going to.
Yeah, but like I've noticed that because I have tattoos on my arms, I don't want to get it removed off my arms. But apparently, they're similar to the lasers that tattoo removal places
use. Oh, that breaks up the color.
Yeah, it actually kind of hits you right around the same. It's like the same frequency, so you have to be really careful.
I mean, when I got my vagina done, I mean, it felt like laser bolts were hitting my vagina. So
yeah, I think
it hurts.
I don't think it's like that anymore.
Really?
Yeah, because how long ago was that?
No, it was like only 2 years ago.
2 years ago. My friend who goes to this one place where I'm going to go told me that they have a new technology where right after the laser pulse, it blasts you with a little puff of cold air. And it just like takes the sting out. She says, you know, you can still feel it, but it's like so much better.
Lightning.
Yeah, I know it's going to hurt. But, you know, we've had tattoos.
Yeah.
That shit hurts.
Yeah.
You know, it's like... It's what you go through to get something permanent.
Exactly.
Which I'm so looking forward to. I don't know how I got off the... Oh, yeah. I was saying that I'm in a relationship and I'm old and I'm boring. Oh, and that was from not lying about our age. And that was from you saying that you were in Jehovah's Witness for 21 years.
For 21 years. Left when I was 26.
So Jehovah's Witness is still considered a Christian religion, right?
Yeah.
From the outside, people don't... It's the same as Mormonism. Like, non-Mormons don't think of Mormons as Christian.
Yeah.
But Mormons think of themselves as Christian because it's like rooted in Protestantism.
Yeah.
Followed the New and Old Testament of the Bible. You just have additional texts on top of that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they're totally Christian. Mm-hmm. They're just a sect of Christianity, mm-hmm. to be quite honest. And they take the Bible very literally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't celebrate holidays. They don't, you know, we really weren't, we can drink, but everything in moderation.
Yeah.
Like, you were, and it's just, it's a lot of control. It's a lot of taking everything literally. It's a lot of policing your brothers and sisters.
Yeah, it sounds very oppressive.
It is. It is. And it's interesting because there's so much control involved of every aspect of your life. They always said, being a Jehovah's Witness is not a religion. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was one of those things where they thought that the control was protection.
Mm.
Like, just turn your brain off. It's fine. Don't trust yourself. We can tell you how to live. And if you just do it our way, you know, and just be self-sacrificing and, you know, you're just a martyr constantly, you know. But what it did do is it bred rebellion, and especially in young people, because, you know, a lot of people would convert when they were older and they, you know, committed their sins and were looking for redemption. And then
they'd already gotten to live kind of a normal life before that.
Yeah, totally. And then you get these kids and they're all zealous because there's, you know, they're drinking the Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get older and they're like, I want to date somebody, or and they're very controlling as to that. No sex before marriage, and that was a big thing. Like, I actually got kicked out of being a Jehovah's Witness for fucking my boyfriend.
That was
a very hard time. They disfellowshipped me.
Ugh.
And so I could go to church, but not, I had to get there right as it was starting so that no one could talk to me. And then I had to leave as soon as it was done.
And of course, all your family knew.
Oh, yeah. And then I lived with my mom and my stepfather at that time when I was disfellowshipped. And they only were able to have limited communication with me.
How old were you?
I was like 23, 24.
Oh, that's like not even young.
Yeah.
I was thinking you were going to say you were like 15.
Oh, no. I didn't start having sex until I was in my 20s.
Probably because you were Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, because I was Jehovah's Witness. I held out, and my boyfriend basically like pressured me into having sex with him. So
was he a Jehovah's Witness?
He was a Jehovah's Witness too.
Oh, so he got disfellowshipped too?
No, because he was never baptized.
What?
Yeah, so I got baptized when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, you can only be disfellowshipped if you're baptized.
Gotcha.
And he never was, and that's why my mom never liked him.
She's gotcha.
Like, he's trouble.
Yeah, so he wasn't really in it.
Yeah, yeah. And he was like looking for a way out constantly.
Yeah.
So it was a thing. But
so when this happens, obviously, how do they find out? How do the
I confess?
Kind of, yeah, you confess because they.
Yeah, I mean, they can find out because they also have people like narking on you all the time. If any, and I grew up in a little city. I grew up in South Central, but then also in Cudahy, Bell Maywood area, which is kind of like in between South Central and East LA.
So you're an Angeleno, like
I've been here since I was five. I'm one of the rare ones.
Yeah,
one of the rare ones for sure. So they're really small towns, so you really can go anywhere without somebody seeing you or knowing you, and so you could get caught real easy. Mm. But I was really good at covering my tracks. I just felt guilty because, you know, the brainwashing was really good.
Yeah.
So I decided I would confess, and they kicked me out of church.
Yeah, you know, somebody in my family had a similar experience where they don't kick you out of the Mormon church, but you can't get married in the temple if you have committed that quote-unquote sin.
Yeah.
And so somebody in my family had a similar thing where it was like just during, you know, one of the meetings with the bishop, they grill you. They ask you all these questions, and I guess you just feel like beholden.
Yeah.
And she admitted that, she and her fiancé had sex before marriage, so then they couldn't get married in the temple. They had to have like a church wedding, so they didn't get all of the sacraments and things. Like all that a lot of like Mormons really are excited about and look up to doing. And it was like it was very hard for her. Like, and it brings a lot of kind of shame
into your heart,
but also
part.
Like through your family, because it's like everyone knows.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, when, especially growing up, like I was definitely on the other side of, of the disfellowshipping where I hadn't experienced that. And I definitely was like, oh, I know that she got kicked out for fucking. Like, yeah. Especially if they were young, you yeah. knew that that was why.
Yeah.
You know? And
and I'm sure that the church, well, I'm not sure, but I would assume that the church leaders might even like be in communication with your family. You
yeah.
know what I mean? That like somehow, like your parents must know.
Oh yeah, your parents. I totally knew kids whose parents turned them in.
Ugh.
You know, it like sisters would turn, you know, their brothers and sisters in. It was just, you would have to narc on your family because they had this scripture that they use. And it said, Christ came not to unite people, but he came to put a sword between mother and daughter and father and son. And, you know, they took that very literally where That's it was crazy. Like your loyalty is ultimately to God.
Yeah.
And that was always something that was really hard for me, especially after I left, because my mom was still in the church and my stepfather. And they basically, when I left, they withdrew their support from me.
Mm-hmm.
Because they teach you to do that so that you can fail and come back.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's less so. So when you look at Scientology, and I know what I know basically from watching this Leah Remini documentary
and Going Clear.
Right now. Yeah, it's so good. And so she's been, you know, she published a book, and then she's been doing this multi part series, and I'm learning all sorts of crazy things about it.
Yeah.
And she talks about how when somebody leaves Scientology, they call them like a repressive person, and
yeah.
they're meant to basically completely cut them off. And
yeah.
And it's really because they're now a threat
yeah.
to your sort of faith.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because they're now outsiders. They're reading
secular
literature. Yeah. And they could like pull you over to that side. But it sounds like it's like a hybridization with Jehovah's Witness, where it's a little bit like what the Amish do, where
yeah.
it's like, if you fall away, it's like, let them go out, experience it, because they'll probably come back.
Well, it's not quite like the Rumspringa, is that
yeah,
what,
yeah,
what
yeah.
it's called? It is, they basically view you as kind of an apostate mm-hmm. type person.
Yeah.
I strategically left in a certain way, because if I was disfellowshipped mm-hmm. and I didn't come back, I would still be under that veil of not being able to talk to anybody at the church, and also my parents having very limited support and contact with me. And my mom was sick for a very, very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it that way. Like, I never met with the elders again. They were always trying to get me to meet with them. And I was like, fuck you guys. I'm not doing that. I know what that's all about.
I did the same thing it's like, apparently I can like officially leave the Mormon church. I
yeah.
have to like write a letter and
yeah,
submit
yeah, yeah.
it. And I'm like, why should I have to do that?
Exactly. And if I did that with Jehovah's Witnesses, that means that like everybody's done with me.
Yeah.
And I can't, like my mom just passed away recently, and that would have meant that I wasn't allowed to go to her funeral.
Yeah.
So it's really fucked up.
I mean, and you were spending a lot of time with your mom when she was very
sick.
Oh,
I took care of her.
Of course. And can you imagine if it was kind of like not kosher for you to
oh,
have
yeah.
been there with her to take care of her in her final days?
I have a sister who is in a disfellowship state, and mm-hmm. she's basically estranged from the family. And I let her know what was going on, but she doesn't talk to us. And I was really upset when, you know, she wouldn't respond to, you know, I told her that my mom was dying. I mm-hmm. told her that my mom had died. I told her when the service was, and she never responded. I talked to my biological father, which we share a biological father. And I was like, is this my sister's number? He's like, oh yeah, that's her number. I'm like, she know, mom. My mom died. He's like, yeah, she was pretty broken up about it. It's like, okay. But then I kind of put myself in her shoes, and I thought, oh, it would be really fucking awkward for her to come to the funeral because she's disfellowshipped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that kind of.
And everybody there is Jehovah's Witness.
And everybody's there, yeah. Jehovah's Witness. And it's really awkward because if they go to like talk to her, like she'd have to sit all the way in the back, all the way to the side. She couldn't interact with anybody whatsoever. And it's just a really fucked up way to grieve.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. So I'm like, all right.
And it's like, why should I have to grieve according to their rules?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. In fact, when I was at the funeral, me and my siblings weren't allowed to talk because we had all left the church. Yeah, we couldn't say anything.
So it's still, even after death, still kind of the faith and the religion is taking priority over intimate family relationships.
Oh, yeah, there are sanctions, yeah. For sure.
And so it was a very religious funeral?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. In fact, a couple of my friends, they went to go visit. I mean, they attended the funeral. Mm-hmm. Several of my friends came and attended the funeral. And a couple of them, I was like, what do you think about all of this? You can be totally honest with me. And they're like, yeah, it's definitely like peeking through the window.
Yeah.
And of like a different world. I'm like, does any of this make more sense? They're like, absolutely not. And they said when they came in, because, you know, there's a lot of Bible and reading scripture and all that. He said, we sat down and the second, like, there's this woman crying next to us. And, you know, the second they talked about going to scripture, we got Bibled. She just was like, and handed them a Bible in her tears. And she says, it was already open to the verse. She's like, I didn't even see her flip to it. He just Bibled her. I was like, yep, that sounds right. I'm like, they know something about their Bible. I could flip to a scripture, you know, back in the day without even thinking twice about it. So
that is hilarious. You know, it's funny because I wonder if the reason that it is so sort of, like you said, it felt like it was peeking behind the veil, that it is so sort of, I don't know, interesting and shrouded and guarded.
Oh, totally.
Is because, you know, obviously it's because there are the teachings to kind of stay very separate from culture. It seems like the only time most people interact with Jehovah's Witnesses, if they're not friends with people, which is unlikely because a lot of them go to like private schools. Is when they come knocking at your door.
Yeah. Yeah.
My only experience with Jehovah's Witnesses, other than like with you, I think, or maybe I know people who are Jehovah's and I just don't know it, but was that when I was living in Texas, a couple of women came to my door and they had like a bunch of pamphlets. I was a very small person when I was younger. Like when I was in late high school, early college, this must have been college, so because I was living alone, I was tiny, tiny. I weighed like 100 pounds.
Yeah.
I was just very tiny.
Yeah.
And so they had all their pamphlets and I knocked on the door. I was like, oh, I opened it. I didn't have people. So I opened it. And they said, have you ever wondered how God could help you with? And they kind of leaped through their pamphlets for a second. And then they pulled one out and they said, eating disorder.
What? Oh, like, my God.
No, you didn't. So I guess they have lots of literature on different, on different problems.
Any subject you can think of. Well, what they would say to discourage you from going to college, they'd say, well, you know, if you just keep up with the Watchtower and Awake magazines, that's equivalent to a college education from all the articles that we publish. And I mean, I never went to college. And I did read a lot of the literature. And it, you know, it's very well researched, but then they put that like Bible spin onto it.
Of course.
So that's very interesting. But
so you were, because you left the church when you were 25, like that's, you know, usually college age is like 18 to 22.
Yeah. And I just never went.
Yeah. You were in the church during prime. And so it's, nobody in the church goes to college. It's just not okay.
Nobody. Uh-huh. It's just one of those things where if you decide to pursue college instead of a full-time career in the ministry, which I chose, it's very like her faith is not as strong. You know,
so it's kind of like, yeah, it's gossipy.
It's very gossipy. It's very whispery. And it's one of those things where, to speak to what you were talking about earlier, it is, there's a scripture that they would always quote saying that we're no part of the world. So we were not able or allowed really to have friends that were not Jehovah's Witnesses or to have, like they would always have, they would say, you have friends and you have associates and you associate with the world, but you can't be friends with anybody in the world. And so that is the very exclusive kind of elitist nature of being a Jehovah's Witness. They keep you poor, they keep you stupid, and you have this elite idea of being above people that don't know God or have a relationship with God like you do, so you don't have to feel bad about constantly sacrificing any type of talent or potential that you have because you're always waiting for the next world, you know? And so, and that was something that I'm realizing now, and I used to be bitter about because I'm like, I didn't go to college. I could have been this. I could have been a great many things if I didn't. But I look back and I'm like, you know, I think everything happened the way it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. And I did learn a lot from that era
in my life experience. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's, oh my gosh, I'm so fascinated. I have so many questions.
Yeah,
I want to take a quick break because I need to thank the sponsors for this week's episode. But as soon as we come back, I have so many questions for Val about growing up Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm really excited to be partnering once again with Blue Apron. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and that's exactly what they're doing. And I really like that they use a sustainable food system. They partner with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. Their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards that were developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, and they can deliver to 99% of the continental U.S. so that even if you live in an area that's considered a food desert, you can cook your meal each night with fresh, healthy food. Now, let me explain to you how it works. You go online, you choose the meals that you want, whether they're for you and your partner or you and your whole family, and you get a box in the mail full of every ingredient you could possibly need to make that dish and nothing more. There's no food waste because they send you perfectly portioned ingredients and a full color, really easy to follow recipe card so that even if you can't cook like myself, you actually can produce some really incredible meals. And it costs only about $10. Actually, it's under $10 per person per meal. So why are you waiting? I mean, look at the things that are coming up. You can get cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice, udon noodle soup with miso and soft boiled eggs. Ooh, I'm excited about that one. Or for the people who love fish, crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Yum, yum. All right, guys. So check out this week's menu and get this. This is the best part. You can get your first three meals for free, absolutely free, with free shipping. You just got to go to blueapron.com/nerdy. Again, that's three free meals, free shipping, if you go to blueapron.com/nerdy. Why wait? All right, let's get back to the show. So we're back with Val Harvey, and we've been talking about her experience as a young Jehovah's Witness, leaving the church after, 21 years, mm-hmm. at the age of 25. And a lot of the kind of protectionism, I guess, is a good way mm-hmm. to put it. The way that the church would kind of prevent you from interacting with the outside world. You made an interesting comment, kind of keep them. You said like keep them stupid and keep them
keep them poor, keep them stupid.
Yeah, and
dependent.
Dependent. And it struck me because you mentioned that you grew up basically in South Central Los Angeles,
yeah.
which is, as we all know, you know, not a wealthy area by any stretch.
Yeah,
you know,
it's one of the most impoverished parts. Poor black child.
Yeah, I mean, and is it like when you think about all of your peers in the church, mm-hmm. like, was it specifically targeted in poorer areas? Was there a bigger community? I would never make a connection between, you know, South Central LA, a predominantly African American, predominantly kind of lower wage area,
yeah.
and the Jehovah's Witness faith. But I guess I never really thought about it before.
Yeah, I think that religion in general really flourishes in areas where people are a little bit destitute and desperate, you know, to feel some sort of redemption and also purpose in life, because, you know, they feel like maybe they don't have a whole lot to offer the world except mm-hmm. for, you know, it's like I'm not allowed into this, you know, I couldn't go to the White House, right? I don't know a lot of really powerful people, but I do know God, and he's the most powerful,
yeah.
you know? So it does take on that elitist form, you know,
yeah.
Because people think that, like, well, I'm friends with the most. And we would talk about having a relationship with God and being friends with God and Jehovah, actually. It's, you know, what we refer to God as. And, you know, that was something that really made us feel powerful,
yeah,
in a way, Yeah. You know, so it was a way for the powerless to feel some sort of power.
While still being kept somewhat powerless.
Exactly, yeah. Without recognizing that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I think about, I grew up in a relatively privileged suburb of Dallas. Mm-hmm. I didn't live in the richest of the rich parts of that suburb. Mm-hmm. I lived kind of in the, like in a lower middle class neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was surrounded by kids with means, and mm-hmm. it was a predominantly white town. We did have a lot of kind of Latino individuals because it's Texas. And,
yeah.
You know, you have a lot of like more Mexican influence.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had obviously black friends, but it wasn't like there were that many black kids at my school.
Right.
You grew up in South Central, I mean, diametrically opposed. You grew up in South Central Los Angeles, which is, you know, a very, very African-American, but also Latino area, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it was South Central for a while, and then we moved to Belle, Maywood, Cudahy area, which is, like, Mexican.
Very Mexican. Yeah.
And, but we're Central American, so we were... You know, we kind of fit in almost better in the Latin area than
we did
in the black
area. Yeah, because your parents spoke
Spanish. Yeah.
But that's what I was interested in, because ostensibly I've always been fascinated by the idea of like self-identification, right? Uh-huh. Because we wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
Like you're like, well, I'm thinking maybe back when you were like 20 years old.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. Uh-huh. I am a daughter. Uh-huh. I am a girlfriend. I am a Panamanian.
Yeah.
I am. You think about all the different ways that we identify from the outside world looking in. You're black.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that you have Latin roots.
Yeah.
You don't speak Spanish. You don't, or at least you don't have a Spanish accent when you speak. And, you know, that's ostensibly kind of how you appear to the outside world.
Right, right.
So walking down the street in an area like that, you know, no heads are turned.
Uh-huh.
I might walk down the street in South Central and I'm like a white girl walking down the street.
Right. That's pretty easy to pick up on.
Yeah. And I have the same thing where it's like, I'm Puerto Rican, but nobody knows it.
Yeah.
I look white.
Yeah.
You know, and so I do identify as Puerto Rican, but I think much more I identify as like a white American woman, because mm-hmm. that's really, I think
how people have treated you.
Yeah, it's how people have treated me, and it's only really my mom. I identify my mother as a Puerto Rican, and mm-hmm. I identify as like being her kin and coming from that.
Yeah.
But I didn't really grow up in it. I didn't really experience it. You know what? Yes, my abuelita never spoke a lick of English. Like, I remember that, but she died when I was quite young, so I didn't have a lot of influence of that. You did. You were born in it, but then you came here very young. So I'm interested in how you culturally kind of identify because of all those different hats.
Yeah, it's really...
And how much it's changed since you've left the church.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a crazy thing for me because I can remember being, you know, first coming to the States and having this very heavy, thick Caribbean accent mm-hmm. sounding and speaking Spanish and going to school and being like roasted for my accent, basically, you know, by the teachers and the kids alike. And I couldn't quite get what they were, you know, trying to put down for me. And I did eventually, you know, assimilate to the black scent, if you will.
And you find yourself kind of identifying more with that convenient, or at
least trying. Because it was convenient. Yeah. It was convenient, and it definitely got me, you know, got the heat off my back, you know. And then we moved into the Latin area, and I kind of assimilated into the so sometimes I kind of sound like a Chola.
Yeah.
So, and then there was this one white girl that went to our school, and we became best friends, and she was like a total Valley girl, and so I kind of picked up that accent. So I float between all sorts of like weird like accents, and you know, sometimes, you know, it's so funny. There's this great Talib Kweli song called Hot Thing. And he says, I love your white voice that you use on the phone when you handle business. And I'm like, yeah, you got to have that white voice. You got to speak business on the phone, you know.
Oh,
and
so
it's so funny because when I worked at Neiman Marcus for a long time. And there was a point where I had a 6-inch mohawk. I think you knew me when I had that 6-inch mohawk. And I would, you know, answer the phones, and they'd call to make appointments with me and be like, hello, this is Valerie. Thank you for calling Neiman Marcus. How can I help you? And I'd make an appointment with them, and then they'd show up for their appointment looking for Valerie. And I'd be like, hey, I'm Valerie. And they'd be like, whoa, what? So I can play the game, you know.
And you find you do have to.
Yeah. You have to. As a Black person or just a person of color in this nation, it really benefits us to integrate.
Yeah.
You know, if I want any type of opportunity or privilege in this world, I have to go where there are white people because that's where the privilege is. But for a white person, if they never saw a Black person or color person in their life would be virtually unchanged.
Yeah.
They
wouldn't, I don't think that they would be as fulfilled or as rich. That's my opinion. Well, I think that the more.
That's like a mentality.
Exactly.
Thing.
But the more you interact with
people.
Privilege,
as far as like economics, yeah. it makes no difference whatsoever. But if you're a person of color, like it is not an option for you. And that's why, as Black people, as brown people, as, you know, we want to be here because this is where we have the opportunity to have a better life and we're being pushed out of that.
Yeah. And you know? I mean, we know that historically African Americans and not just African Americans, Latino Americans, Jews, you know, a lot of different ethnic groups sort of, like you said, were pushed into certain neighborhoods and like going all the way back to tenements that they never were able to really leave. And so you're right. If you are like a white person from the suburbs and you were like you don't even ever have to go to those places.
Never.
You never have to see them.
Yeah.
And
but if I wanted, you know, a better education as a Black person, I would have to force my way into a white school neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those things where people kind of always think we're complaining, but it's like we're not complaining. We want to be viewed as equal so that we can have the same opportunities. Like we do want a better life and we do want to, you know, be smarter and learn things. And we can't do that unless we all, you know, come together. And it's just so heartbreaking when, you know, people are pushed into the shadows because it just makes their life so less fulfilled. But it also makes, you know, the life of people who aren't, you know, people of color, you know,
absolutely,
not rich as well, you know?
Yeah, what kind of a life is it to grow up in, like, you know, a town in the South where you never, ever leave, first of all. Mm-hmm. You never leave, so you never see any other culture. You never interact with anybody from a different culture. And so you just have these very hardline views.
Yeah, you know? that are all manufactured and put into your television, and that's what you think.
Yeah, and often are based on fear.
Because, 100%.
Because you fear what you don't know and what you don't interact with.
Well, also, like, if you saw the documentary, The 13th, you know, we talked about that and how, like, one of the major turning points went, and that was that, you know, The Birth of a Nation was the birth, you know, came out around the birth of motion pictures.
Yeah.
And
we're talking, of course, about the famous Nazi, or not Nazi, but like KKK propaganda film.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was made to just propagate the hatred of Black people and justify it so that it, you know, and it goes back to economics to keep that going so that they could, you know, basically fuel their evil means without any type of ramifications whatsoever. And it's continued through the years where people, like, I was just in Utah for the Sundance Film Festival, and I was like, wow, you guys really only see Black people once a year. I was just walking through the airport, and I felt like a unicorn.
Oh, yeah, especially, like, in Utah.
Yeah,
oh,
the
it's so
stairs
white.
And the... I was like, you know, I live in California, this liberal bubble, and I just never think about it anymore.
That's true. Because living in LA, you see all kinds of people. I mean, everybody lives in LA.
Exactly. And I mean, there was a point in time back in the 80s where if I were to go into a white neighborhood, I would be escorted out very quickly.
Yeah.
And it would be like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
But that has since gotten better. It's not past.
It's true. And it
but
depends on where
better.
You live, too.
Yeah.
Like, now that I'm in Los Feliz, I definitely notice more and more often. Like, now that we've bought a house, I notice, like, it's, like, white here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very gentrified. I mean, there's still a lot of Latina people because I think historically this was a Latina area. Mm-hmm. And then it, like, it became gentrified. But I used to live in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And in Hollywood, it's, like, everybody lives in Hollywood.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's, like, a melting pot.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And so I kind of miss that. And I find myself going back to Hollywood and spending a lot of time there because I like to, or like when I go to Glendale because it's just closer, everybody's Armenian. It's like, you know, because you have these settlement
pockets.
Areas. Yeah, it's true.
For sure.
Yeah, it's strange, you know. It's it's like we want to see full integration, yet we also totally understand and value an interest in maintaining a cultural identity and in being around, you know, like-minded people who speak your language, who hold on to the same maybe religious or cultural values. And it's always that kind of push-pull between.
Giving up power.
And also maintaining your own identity that brings pride and and interest and integrating into this. I think the problem is if it always feels like I'm trying to integrate into white culture, that's going to be really like a turnoff. If
it
feels
because
like I'm trying
I'm
to integrate
never...
into American culture, which is supposed to be, a nation of immigrants and a melting pot. But
we all know how that's going.
I know. And that's really what is.
It's turning into injury. Yeah. Like when I've never really had the impetus to to blend into American culture as I have into white culture.
Yeah.
And that's just because that is where I would have, I could get anything accomplished in my life, anything better added to my life. And it's very interesting that I've never really even considered it that way, but it is getting into white culture. But there is one thing that is missing from that for me that I am always kind of reminded of. So, because I am not white and I'm never going to be.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important when we see historic steps, like Barack Obama being elected president of the United States, like seeing people of color and women and LGBT individuals in positions of power.
Yeah, we need it.
We need it because the more that it happens, the more it becomes normalized. And then it really is about integrating into American culture and not white culture.
Yeah.
As long as it's just white people in power, it's always, I gotta play the white game.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why it's so depressing to see this utter backlash from Barack Obama. We made so much progress, and then Trump in so many ways was this like really negative consequence of the individuals who are not okay with that kind of progress really speaking out. And the fact that Bannon has been put in such a position of power next to Trump, and he is a known white nationalist from Breitbart, and he is known to harbor like such horrifically backward racist views. You see them just in the way that Trump talks. You see them in the way he acts. Obviously, the Muslim ban is a big, slap in the face.
Yeah.
But it's even more than that. Like, he'll talk about the inner city, and he always just talks about crime in the inner
city.
Yeah,
because
it's a euphemism.
Yeah. Well, he's fallen victim to the same pitfalls as a lot of white America. That it's in, in that 1% where the only time they are ever exposed to black culture is on television, and it's skewed a certain way to make us, just to keep us there.
And it's especially annoying that that's the case for Trump, because Trump grew up in fucking New York City. He grew up in the most culturally diverse place in this entire country, yet he grew up with so much privilege that he was able
to avoid color altogether.
And
that's, you can't, like I said, that goes to my point. As a white person, your life is unaffected.
Yeah, it's true. And the only time that he ever really had to deal with race when he was, we've seen this, like if you watch this incredible documentary on Frontline called The Choice, I think. It was really just following Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump through their entire political career and their political aspirations, taking them to where they were right as the election was happening. And then they did some follow-ups on Trump as president. And it details very well, like the lawsuits that Trump and his father dealt with unethical, real estate practices where they were basically barring black people from renting in their properties.
Yeah.
And they just doubled down. They were unapologetically fought back against it. This man does not have any sort of track record or history of unification or of, pride in a country of immigrants, other than the fact that if we didn't have immigration, he would have no wives,
basically, or workers.
Exactly. Yeah, like he would be
he'd have no help.
He'd have no help. That's true.
Yeah.
It's just, and which makes it, again, easy to kind of consider people second-class citizens.
Oh, 100%. But then again, it's one of those things where, like, I just thought it was hilarious that on Saturday Night Live, Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock were like, psh, yeah, how could Trump win? It was so tongue-in-cheek, and it was great because for many people of color, Trump does represent a reality that has existed in our world.
It's true.
Forever. You know, it's like white people are just like, oh my God, how did this happen?
But
I'm like, that's how I lived my life. Yeah. Like, that's always how it's been for me. I haven't really experienced anything besides that, except for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
That was our first experience.
Yeah, it's true. And I sit here and I'm like, how could this happen?
And we're like, shit, we've been... I go, this ain't the first time an old white racist man has been running this country.
It's true. I think what has changed for the perspective of white people is that, especially those who are like dramatically opposed to this kind of a regime, like myself, is that what we always knew racism existed, obviously, and we always knew we hadn't made the progress that we needed to make. Yeah. And so that's why, just as an aside, the like All Lives Matter people and the people who kind of like pretend like equality, like parity has been reached and equality has been reached, so why should any sort of underrepresented minority get any sort of special privilege? You know, the people who like act out against affirmative, like those assholes who just don't get it.
Yeah.
I think in so many ways, it's because in white society, it has not been in white, especially where I grew up in the South, sort of, but I didn't grow up in like the deep South. I grew up in metropolitan areas in Texas, pleasant society. Mm-hmm. Racism existed, but like those were the racist people.
Yeah.
Like you'd be like, oh, that woman's racist. Like, but she's behind the times. And anybody who was overtly racist was like poo-pooed, but it was seething under the radar. And now there's been this transition where it's overt again.
Oh yeah.
But that doesn't really mean anything has changed. It just means people are more emboldened to say what they want to say anyway.
Exactly. Like it was always there. It was always under the surface. I could feel it. And a lot of my friends, and again, because I've had to integrate, a lot of the times I do find myself as that token black person, that I'm the one black person that's allowed because I'm not, you know, like I would get when I was growing up, oh, you're not like them.
Ugh,
because I could speak, you know, because I spoke a certain way and I carried myself a certain way. So I was allowed to join the white people, you know, and...
And you are very kind of you have varied interests, and I think a lot of it, like all black people have varied interests, but a lot of people try to paint individuals with a broad brush, you know, like solos only listen to this kind of music.
Exactly.
Black people only listen to gangster rap, and you've got like a Joy Division tattoo. So what, that's not normal. Black people don't like Joy Division. It's like some black people like Joy Division.
Yeah, why not? Why I've got ears. Exactly. I can listen to whatever I want. I can appreciate music.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it was one of those things. So my friends, like this is my frustration, because I, you know, obviously like I love white people, I love everybody. But my frustration is when my friends, or when I hear people who are against affirmative action or against Black Lives Matter, or against their, you know, they just kind of make it seem like we're complaining all the time about getting, which is, and it's like my frustration is that they feel like they've let us have equality, and that's the operative word. It's like, well, you have this now, and you have
let you have it.
And it's like, you do not have the monopoly on equality. Like, we should have had those things to begin with. It's not like you've let us have it. You've oppressed and repressed us from having it, but it wasn't yours to dictate how it should be given.
Yeah.
And that's my frustration.
Like, that is so inherent in white privilege.
Yeah.
That because they were the oppressors for so long, that then any move to lift oppression is somehow a gift.
Exactly. And it's like, aren't we so great? We let you have a black president, but you know,
That's disgusting.
Like, we let you have this, and we let you.
Insulting, really.
Oh, it's so, and it's not even just with black people, it's with women, it's with, you know, it's with any type of, it's like they get to dictate who has equality, and it's not fair. And that's why we keep complaining.
Yeah,
but that's
so
why
even
we keep
find
fighting.
Saying it,
yeah,
you hear it
so
so
we
much.
Keep. Yeah, and like a lot of my white friends would be like, "Ugh, here she goes again," and I'd be like, "No,
that's horrible."
And I see it
with the women's movement hugely on social media. Some of the very people listening to this podcast are what have kind of become, I don't know if they've labeled themselves or if other people have labeled them, these MRAs, these men's rights activists. And I see them popping up and yelling, calling me a social justice warrior, which they use as a derogative term, which to me, I'm like, I'm a social justice warrior.
Yeah.
Like, of course I want social justice. And this idea that somehow, that we're complaining, quote unquote, that Barack Obama is trying to, stop reproductive rights by putting in the global gag order or by backing the Hyde Amendment or by preferentially, saying that he supports. There was that women's march right after the real women's march where, like, the pro-lifer people marched. And, like, he doesn't say anything about the real women's march except celebrity culture has made them think about these things backward. Why didn't they come out and vote? And I'm like, fuck you. I did come out and vote. And you lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. Like, those were the women at the women's march.
Yeah.
Like, come on. But then he's like, oh, yay for the pro-life march afterward. Like, there's just this all-out assault, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet you see this culture on social media of people being like, oh, stop complaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, oh, you know, you just want to whine. Why don't you do something about it? And it's like, fuck you. Do you understand how hard I work?
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
To get equal treatment as men.
Yeah.
And then to be a black woman. I mean, we can talk about this. Like, there's obviously
so many layers to it.
There's so many layers, but there's psychological studies that show, like, it's actually a really interesting psychological study about society and race, where it's an ingenious plan. They sent actors, quote unquote, to different car dealerships to negotiate the cost of a new car.
Mm-hmm.
And across the board, no matter how many times they did it, white men got the best deal. White women got the next best deal. White men got the best deal. Black men got the next best deal. White women. No. Yes. White women got the next best deal. And then black women got the worst deal. Mm-hmm. And it kind of follows a historical path, right?
Oh, yeah.
Of like black men could vote before white or any women. And black women have been historically, you know.
Shit on.
Oppressed. Yeah. Worse than anyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, Muslims are coming up, like,
it's getting there.
Coming up high.
It's getting there. That's true. And so, but like, how many Muslims are black? You know what I mean? A fuckload of them. We forget about the African Muslims.
Yeah.
Like, there are a lot, like the Somali Muslims and the Egyptian, you know.
Selling bean pies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We forget that that's a huge religion in
the black culture, too. Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I get so frustrated by this mentality. And I don't even know how to respond to it when these, like, quote unquote men's rights activists, like, start kind of harassing. Obviously, I just block. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they're very smart, scientifically minded people who just are so fucking disconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not their experience. So they can't imagine anything outside of what their world is and don't want to.
Yeah. It's like, I see, for example, like, I was raised in a Southern, very conservative household. My father voted for Trump. I think that he's struggling right now with the back, and he's trying to rationalize a lot of things, and he's still kind of like, let's be in the wait and see mode. And it's like, how much more do we need to wait and see? But you know, he definitely doesn't defend anything racist, but I who knows what kind of implicit racial biases are there. And that's why I see, and maybe this is me trying to justify, a difference between the quote-unquote the quote unquote closing some doors for more privacy just so we can hear better.
I can fully hear my alarm going off.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even hear it. But it's like in my mind, and I don't know why I do it, but it's kind of the way that we still protect our Mormon families, and we kind of justify some of the things, even though we're like, I fucking disagree with everything. But
yeah.
I find myself going, there's the quote unquote, the bullshit All Lives Matter people that are just and I try as often as I can, or I did when that was really trending. People are like, All Lives Matter. And I'm like, that's racist. You can't say that.
Yeah.
Like, you
know,
because there's the people who are saying it because it's a backlash to Black Lives Matter and because it's racially And then there's the people who are so fucking dense that they don't realize all of the context around the movement. And they don't realize that saying, of course, all lives matter. That's not the fucking point.
Yeah.
The point is that we are targeted. Black lives are targeted. Exactly. And they're historically disenfranchised.
Yeah.
And you can't level the playing field by all of a sudden just saying it's level.
Yeah. That's not what it takes.
No. Equality. It's a good argument. When my boyfriend and I have a tiff, mm-hmm. doesn't happen often.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it happens. He may say or do something that offends me or hurts my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just act like nothing happened,
yeah.
because we haven't yet gotten back to the regular to the natural kind of default state of being. He has to be overly awesome to me in order to make up for the awfulness until we're back to being
level.
And that's really, I think, what affirmative action is all about. It's about ensuring that there are carved out opportunities for individuals who are disenfranchised because the system doesn't allow for equality yet.
Yeah. 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 I mean, systematically, we are kept down.
Mm-hmm. And people have implicit bias. It's gotten to be so bad. Bad, that African Americans themselves have implicit bias against African Americans.
Oh, yeah.
Women themselves will on self-report measures that show like unconscious bias will show that they think men are stronger than women or men are more capable.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. It's what happens when society feeds you this poison for so
it's
long.
It's like being in a zoo, you know, where an elephant is ultimately more powerful than a human. But if you break him, then he forgets that he's an elephant. Mm-hmm. He forgets that he's powerful. And he submits to this weaker human. And that's, I think, a lot of the position that a lot of us are in. We forget our power because we've been broken down to forget who we really are. And, you know, when I think about, you know, the Black Power movement or, you know, like just Black Proud, Brown Pride, you know, because we've been taught that our hair was bad, our skin color, everything was constantly, anything that you see, you know, in society or advertising that's good and that you want is inherently white.
Yeah.
And so we had these movements to help us to appreciate our kinky hair and to help us appreciate our dark skin and to know that that was beautiful. But a lot of people, you know, outside of our race were, you know, they thought somehow if we thought that that was okay, that it would take away from them, that Black pride meant white hate, but that's not it. It's just helping us to appreciate and love who we are. It's self-love. And that's a dangerous place for people who want to stay in power, because if an elephant loved that he was an elephant and all his power, then there would be no fucking zoos.
Exactly. And that is really scary to the
people in power.
What's growing to be a minority of rich white men.
They're terrified.
They're terrified.
And that's what is going on in this country.
Take America back, make America great. Yeah. Again, like all of this shit is basically just like white nationalism.
Exactly. I don't want to give up the power. They see it fading and they don't want to give it up. And it's their desperate attempt to grasp and hold on to it.
And in doing so, they equate like what you were just defining as Black power with violence and aggression. Like there's always been this longstanding like smear campaign, this propaganda campaign.
Yeah.
That like
starting with Birth of a Nation.
Exactly. Black people are scary. Yeah. We should be afraid of them because they're going to rape and kill our white women.
Don't trust them. Control them.
I mean, the overt racism that we saw when Barack Obama was in office showing him as like an ape, showing him. I mean, it's just
heartbreaking.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
And it must bring back themes that like a lot of young Black kids, I'm sure that they experience, you know, systemic and under the radar racism, but they probably, depending on where they live, wouldn't have experienced a kid walking up to them and calling them a fucking ape.
Yeah.
You know, like just overt, disgusting. Yeah. And now with the rise of this Trump regime, it's somehow okay again.
Oh yeah. Say what you were thinking.
Say
all
it
along.
Just wear it on your sleeve. It's horrific.
It is. It's terrible. It's so terrible.
And it must be such a tough position. I mean, I'm freaking out. I'm losing my shit. I'm so depressed, and I'm so worried of the kind of longstanding damage that this is going to cause, both for our internal society as Americans, but also definitely with our relationship to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I can only have so much perspective on that. I can't imagine how afraid, how, and just disappointed individuals who saw so much progress, individuals who identified with Barack Obama. I identified with him, but not in the core way that, you know, potentially you did.
Yeah.
And then to see this fucking fucknut get into office and actually make good on a lot of his promises.
I know. Oh, it's terrifying, but again.
Yeah, it's like, what do we do?
I am continuing to live my life and to try to, you know, be an example of the opposite of what I'm, you know, what mass media is trying to perpetuate me to be.
Yeah.
And I've done that my whole life. I fought against those stereotypes my whole life, you know, so it's nothing unusual for me, except that now I have a lot more people supporting me.
Yeah.
Which is nice and comforting, you know. Like, I think a lot of my white friends get it now. They're like, oh, I guess she wasn't as crazy. And she would say A, B, and C. That is really happening. I'm like, that's my world.
It's just you saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, this is what I experienced. And now it's just, there's proof of it. There's tangible
and now it's
evidence.
Just so obvious to everybody. Yeah, you can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I really appreciate, it's funny because I wanted to have you on because I was like, oh, we haven't done a religion episode in a while. And it's actually reminding me of, I'm actually like a little embarrassed and pretty ashamed that it's taken this many episodes to really sit down and have an honest conversation and an open conversation about race and about these issues here in America. And it's making me realize how much more often I need to do this. And so I really appreciate you being super frank and open and allowing me to ask some potentially even naive questions. And, you know,
it's okay, man. Like, I'm so happy that we are having this conversation and that it's not one of those things where, because a lot of people that I, you know, if I start to get into it, they get all uncomfortable and don't want to entertain any thought outside of, I we're in 2017, so nobody's racist anymore, you know, and they don't want to consider any other experience. They're just like, you've got the right to A, B, and C, and that's that, and the book is closed, and there's no more of that. And that, in fact, is racist, you know, but the fact that we're having this conversation, that other people are going to be able to hear it and maybe think twice about certain ideals, because in my opinion, I don't really think that everybody's racist. I think that there's just so much ignorance out there, and so many people that aren't willing to consider that, you know, because of social conditioning, you are predisposed to thinking a certain way. And because of environment, you are not exposed to another way of life. And therefore, you have a certain train of thought and you believe a certain way, and you can't imagine that other people have to deal with that because you never have. But if you're at all willing to say, you know, and I, you know, like, talk to that one friend that you have that's maybe Black or Latin, or, you know, if you're a white person, maybe you only have that one friend and you're like, well, I'm not racist, I have one.
Or like your one gay friend.
Exactly. Yeah. And ask them, you know, like, just out of, you know, wanting to learn how to treat people better and to be better. Like, has there been anything that I've ever said that offended you? Have I ever done anything? You know, like, it's just a way. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It just means that you are coming from a place of ignorance. But if you ask, you can learn.
Yeah. If you can become aware of your ignorance, you can work towards
And it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. Just like, drop that stigma that I'm going to call you, you're fucking racist and you said this and that. No, I'm happy to help you understand my experience as I want to understand your experience and live and work together. But we're never going to get to that place if we're not having conversations like this.
And don't just stay within your siloed kind of area of information and entertainment. Get outside of your bubble. Watch documentaries like 13th, you know? Watch, there are a ton of beautiful and brilliant movies that are up for a lot of awards right now that really give you insight into, like, we were just talking about Black Brokeback, right?
Moonlight. Moonlight's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah, and just really read you, the new Jim Crow.
Yes, it gives you, you know, insight into a culture that maybe you don't come across. Because it's very hard to exercise what I consider to be the most important human trait, which is empathy.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to exercise empathy if you never experience other cultures and other viewpoints.
Yeah. Yeah.
The most empathetic people on the planet are those who have taken the time to learn from people who are different than themselves and listen to opinions that mm-hmm. are different than their own. It's really hard to empathize with a Black person living in the inner city unless you've had a conversation with a Black person living in this mm-hmm. inner city. It's also hard to empathize with a Black person living in the inner city unless you've had a conversation with a white racist living in a rural America so that you know where they are coming from.
Yeah.
Because until you really understand all of these perspectives and admit to yourself that they exist and yeah. they're pernicious,
yeah.
It's very difficult. It's easy to pretend this yeah. shit's not happening.
Word.
And so you got to find, but you also have to find balance because I get sucked into Twitter and I get sucked into the news and I get so depressed that I can't even function. And so you've got to find balance and remember that you're still the arbiter of your own life. You can mm-hmm. find joy in the things you do.
Yeah.
Right. And you can continue on. I didn't even mention, it's funny because we started talking about Jehovah's Witness, but I mentioned that you're a makeup artist, right?
Oh,
you're
yeah.
a celebrity makeup artist. You do, beautiful. Oh my God.
Thank you.
You've made me feel prettier than anyone else in the world. Seriously.
I love that.
And you also, there's so much more depth to your approach. We didn't really talk about the racial implications of makeup, but there's a long history there, right? Of often would a Black woman, you've been on camera too. Have you ever sat down with a white makeup artist who's like, oh, I don't have your foundation?
All time. Yeah. All time. Well, it's one of those things, really interesting. I just did Sundance and it was the first time I ever went and I was super proud because I was there doing the executive producer of a show called Underground. Mm-hmm. And it's about the Underground Railroad and the executive producer is Black and she really wanted a Black makeup artist to do her makeup. And as I was being vetted for this job, I submitted my portfolio and it mostly had white people in it.
Yeah.
And that's happened to me more than once where a Black person looking for a Black makeup artist, because it is very difficult, you know, because like even my portfolio is very, very white.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that I don't want to do more Black people. It's just
Black people the opportunity.
On TV. Yeah. The opportunity is not as prevalent.
And that
is a reflection. Yeah, and the products. I mean, it's gotten a lot better because I also started in cosmetics, like selling cosmetics, and it was always one thing. Where are the colors? Where are all the colors that blah, blah, blah puts out? And I was like, well, that's Lily White, so that's not even going to work for me. So I don't know what you want me to do about that.
Exactly. It's like there would be like 20 shades of white
exactly.
and then like 2 shades of Black. It's like you're either black or kind of black.
Exactly. Like, or like Latin black. Like, it's like that.
You can be white porcelain white.
And right.
It's like, I can't even tell the difference between these two white shades.
Yeah.
Yet these African American shades, or just I should say these like
the
deeper
two.
Tones.
Yeah, the two
like
deeper
two?
Show
Are you
tones.
Me?
Yeah, for sure. Ugh. So it's just one. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely experienced that in my industry where I would love to work with more people of color, but you can see where the opportunity is in, you know, because it makes sense that, you know, you see a white person, white makeup artist is, you know, portfolio and you're like, oh, she does. And then you look at this Black girl, they're like, where are all the Black girls? I'm like, well, yeah, where are they?
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah. Oh, that's so depressing.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing for me. So I had to like literally show them a picture of myself and be like, well, I've been doing a Black girl's makeup for 20 years, so I'm good. I can do this.
Yeah.
Like I may not do them all the time, but I do them all. I do one all the time.
Yeah. I do my own face every
day.
Yeah,
so I get it.
And how great though, or inspiring. I mean, it's inspiring to me at least that amidst all of this horribleness, mm-hmm. we have these incredible representatives who just like swept at the SAG Awards.
Yeah.
We know they're going to sweep at the Oscar.
Yeah.
I mean, the nominations, it's like the most diverse award season I've seen in a very long time.
Well, it is the first time that it's been this diverse.
That's
which
true.
Is
I should
great,
say that I've ever seen.
But sad.
But
too.
Sad. Super sad.
It's like, it's right. What is it, 2017? And this is the first time?
I know, like you
it's
look at
so crazy to me.
You look at Hidden Figures, which is very near and dear to my heart because of the science as
well—the
women and the science, and you know the race issues.
Yeah,
but this is a movie about women in the '60s.
Yeah.
And it's reflected in the attitudes in 2017.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Finally, we're hearing about that.
Finally.
I was watching Saturday Night Live, and it was so hilarious because Leslie, what's her name? The awesome black chick.
Oh, yeah.
She
yeah.
was
from
on,
Ghostbusters and everything.
Yeah, from
else.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, she's so great.
And she was like, you know what? I'm so sick of the peanut butter guy. That's all anybody ever talks about during Black History. He made peanut butter. You know?
And she's Carver. Like,
yeah, George Washington Carver. I'm so sick of hearing about peanut butter. We did more than just make peanut butter. Did you know that a black woman invented caller ID? Somebody should have called Shirley back. She invented a way to find out who called.
That is
so
funny.
I was like, you know what? You're right. Because for black history, that's all I've ever grown up hearing about. Martin Luther King and George Washington Carver, but we done did other things.
I know. Yeah, you never heard about Katherine Johnson. You
know
what I mean? And she's still alive.
Yeah.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
Ugh, I know. And it's, yeah, we see it in science too. It's like the women are overlooked. The people of color are fucking overlooked.
Yeah.
Just left or right. I don't know if I've gotten to brag a little and then I think we'll start to wrap things up. But a little tooting my own horn. I was very lucky. It's not even a brag. I'm so grateful that I got to be involved in some of the promotional stuff around Hidden Figures because of my science background, where there's an app that you can download that is it's an IBM and New York Times kind of partnered app about Hidden Figures. It has all sorts of great interviews with the cast and cool stories about the three women that were represented in the film. But there's also a cool what do you call it? Augmented reality portion, mm-hmm. where in your city there are quote unquote statues all around your city. They're not real; they're augmented, representing both the three women that were in the film and then seven other historical figures that were either African American, female, or otherwise underrepresented. Some disabled individuals who were like early engineers and scientists, and you walk up to these quote unquote statues, these kind of augmented reality statues. And then there's a biography that's read, and I got to like write and do all the audio for
that's
the biography,
awesome.
Which was so much fun.
I gotta
fun.
Hear that.
Yeah, it was really an incredible opportunity. Because obviously I care about this shit really deeply, but B, I got to dig deep. Like I've never really had a full opportunity. Katherine Johnson, yes, because she's pretty famous within circles who know of her.
Yeah.
But I got to dig deep into these characters who really were hidden. Their Wikipedia entries at the time of working on this were tiny. And then IBM and the New York Times and all of these wonderful organizations that work together beefed them up with good historical documentation. But it was really fun. And I don't know. I just, you got to see Hidden Figures.
Oh, I know.
And read the book, too, because the book's stunning.
Gonna do it.
Okay, so... First, I want to thank you for being here. We got
to
do this again.
Oh,
second,
be happy to.
I hope you're okay with it, but I close every podcast asking my guests the same two questions.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to hear your answers to the two questions. And I apologize in advance because they're kind of big picture and
don't ever.
The scope is okay. But so the first one is, when you think about the future, put yourself in that mindset. And in whatever context it matters to you, so it could be your own personal future,
or it could be
kind of the future of the nation, the future of the globe, the future of humanity. First, what is the thing, if you had to pick one thing, which is hard, that kind of keeps you up the most at night, that worries you, that concerns you, that is very, you know, heavy on your heart? And then the second question, so we don't totally cry at the end of the episode, is the opposite of that. What is the thing that you're most kind of excited and hopeful and optimistic about when you think about the future? I know. I'm an asshole.
That's heavy duty. The thing that I like worry about is basically Trump having nuclear codes because like I said before, like it's not the first time an old white racist man has like, you know, run this country. Mm-hmm. And so that I'm not worried about at all. I know I can get through that. I know like we've gotten through that before. It's just the unpredictable nature of this man that kind of like worries me that we won't have a world or that, you know, we'll just, you know, have a civil war or some sort of like weirdness. Like I talked to this awesome driver in Utah, and he's originally from Europe and he's older. He's like, you know, in his 40s, and he talked about his father said that he feels like the atmosphere right now is you know, like what built up to World War II. You know, he mm-hmm. was living in, you know, Europe during that time. So that's a little terrifying for me. But what really sustains me through all of that is that I do feel and understand what it is like to persevere in the face of these type of pressures because of being a Black woman. And I know that ultimately evil will not prevail. And I know that there are people in this world that, you know, maybe thought that it was going to be easy street to having certain rights, you know. But when you look at how long Black people have been struggling to gain rights, it never came easy, and it ain't all here yet. Yeah. So it just means you just got to stay focused. I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to support my LGBT brothers and sisters. I'm happy to support my Muslim brothers and sisters. I'm happy to, you know, I am so for protecting and embracing Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. I am so for women's rights. I am so for Black Lives Matters. I support it all. I support an equal world. Mm-hmm. And I know that those conversations are going on around the world. So in that way, you know, there's always hope, and there's always beauty that springs from the kind of stagnant fertilization of, you know, because it's, for, you know, when you think of fertilizer, it's all dead shit.
Yeah, it's all and poop.
It's all poop. It's all yeah. shit. And, you know, fucking Trump, he's just shitting on everything, and these fucking, you know, just his cabinet, they're shitting on everything. But you know what? We grow in shit. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's true. And you know what? That's really what gives me hope, is that he may be one man, he may be one very fucking powerful man, mm-hmm. but there are millions and millions of people who are not going to let this happen.
That's right.
We are not going to allow the foundational principles of what make it so great to be American, mm-hmm. the idea of democracy, of one individual, one voice, mm-hmm. and of equality. You know, we are a nation of immigrants. We yeah. are a nation of
many
individuals.
Experiences.
Yeah. We don't have there. What does it mean to be American? It means a million different things.
Yeah. One experience, you know, does not define all.
No, we are not, and like we will some not of be those pushed, countries yeah. where there are, where the native individuals are the really the only individuals that live there. Mm-hmm. We unfortunately suppressed is a light way to put it, you know, mm-hmm. Obliterated our native people, which is disgusting. The European imperialists that came over did so. Mm-hmm. Although even they are strong and are pushing back, you know, yeah. and are doing amazing activism right now. Yeah. But we've blended so seamlessly those native individuals with people from across the world.
Yeah.
What does it mean to be American? It means to be from everywhere else yeah. and from here.
And from here. Native Americans, yeah.
I know.
Like,
and so
big, lots of support to them as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. And so I this is only going to improve. I mean, it might get worse in the moment, yeah. but we won't let it, yeah. we won't let it like beat us down.
Yeah.
And we have legal recourse. And I'm super proud of the ACLU and all of the constitutional lawyers that are working around the clock and not sleeping to help protect our rights. Yeah. And
we won't be forced into the shadows.
No, I want to thank them for that. So Val, thank you for coming on the show. Before you go, I want people to know where they can say hi and say that they, you know, that they learned from this conversation.
My handle is Mohawk Makeup across mm-hmm. the board.
So Twitter, Facebook, and Insta.
Well, actually, Insta and Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm Val Harvey on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I've got a project that I'm working on right now called More Than Just Lipstick, which is coming soon.
And that's going to be on YouTube, or you're not sure?
It's
going
to be
yet.
On YouTube, we'll be on YouTube, and good. It will also be a blog. So yeah. stay tuned for that. It'll be Yay. Really great.
I'm so excited. And you've just kind of started doing it.
I just recorded my first episode, so we are in the production process.
Yes, I can't wait until it comes out. And this is really like an exploration of, you know, doing makeup, making a woman feel beautiful, but understanding all of the things that are beyond what what that relationship of being in the makeup chair has to offer.
Yeah,
right?
Beauty comes within.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's bringing that to the surface.
I love that. Well, Val, thank you again for coming on the show. It was so enlightening. I kept you way longer than I promised I would. So.
No worries. We had some great conversation.
I know. And I know I learned
day.
A lot. I know. And I hope that a lot of my listeners did. And guys, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.